Hi, Andreas.
Hello, hello.
Thank you for joining us today. We'll be talking today about your hit series, Sissi. Obviously, Sissi has or still has to a certain extent, almost iconic status in Germany, in Austria, maybe even in Switzerland to a certain extent. And the classic films trilogy has been screened on the TV in these countries for many, many years. We're a staple through the Christmas holidays, sometimes even Easter. The films are very firmly part of the film genre we'll be referencing today during our conversation. The film genre is, of course, Heimatfilm. Your series is obviously has a direct connotation to the Sissi films, but is also very, very different and a modern version. And to quote from a press text, the sugar sweet frosting of the 1950s is juxtaposed with the complex modern life of a woman who suffered numerous strokes of fate, but always remained true to herself in her independence, which is obviously a great quote. For you, who's so very close to the series, how would you describe the series, ideally in three words?
You just did. Don't you want to watch the show? It is exactly what our series set out to do. We wanted to create a show that brings people into the tent, because many people in Europe know that iconic love story, especially in the German speaking, but also in our direct neighbors, France, Italy, the Netherlands. Interestingly enough, not so much on the Anglo-Saxon side. They don't really know what that whole thing is. So that's always a challenge. And also with the title telling an American that we're producing a show about Sissi leaves all whole world for connotations open. But we're, you know, I'm personally proud. I live part of the time in the United States. Very happy that the show is on PBS. And there it is called The Austrian Empress, which actually makes it easier for the Americans to understand.
Yeah.
But you asked what the show is about. The show is a love story. It's this love story between a most fascinating young woman who falls in love with a very complicated man. And through her trials and tribulations, especially when it comes to this relationship with the emperor, at times is very successful. And at other times, she bites off more than she can chew. And that is an amazing way to get into a story that has a connection back to movies that were made 70 years ago. And, you know, we're incredibly proud, the entire team, the writers, the producers, the directors, the actors, to be in direct line with such iconic movies that we continue to watch even today. So, you know, our audience watches our show now in the third season, soon to be in a fourth season.
Yeah.
But they also watch the old ones.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always a conversation, who is the real empress, the real Sissi? And frankly, I don't care. Romy Schneider was the real Sissi 70 years ago.
Yeah.
For many, she remains just that. For a new generation of people that love that story, that love that love story, that love that character, it is Dominique Davenport, who I think is enormously talented. She has absolute star appeal, and I will always look at Romy Schneider and Dominique Davenport, and I'm happy I can watch both of them, and I'm very happy I'm working with them.
Nice. Now, you sort of touched on that a little bit already. The films were made over 70 years ago. What made you want to tell this story of Sissi now? And also, although the question is quite obvious, are you a fan of the original Sissi films?
You know, interestingly enough, I remember watching them as a little boy with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I mean, to this day, I remember after there was a Sunday, I walked back into my room, I pulled out the Blockhaus, you know, and
yeah.
Looked it up. And it's like, who is this person? And I read it, and it's like, oh my God, it's a real person. I don't know. I must have been like 10 or something like that.
Yeah.
And I liked it. I loved the big emotions that you got. I think back, you know, when I was a 10-year-old, filmmaking wasn't what it is today. And so comparing the way the movies were made back then and the way we're making television series right now, it has progressed, thankfully, quite a bit. But interestingly, those movies you can still watch. There's always mm-hmm. this certain, you know, nostalgia that goes with it. And you can still watch it. And when you ask, well, why this? Well, because it has everything that is relevant today. Even the old movies had a young woman who was forging her own way, who met quite some resistance, who was struggling with love and was struggling with her position in society. Granted, different society than the ones that you and I live in, but those struggles are real for those people that live in that particular cage. And when you look at it, these are all the ingredients that make a great television show, even in the 21st century. Your job as a showrunner, as a writer, and as a producer is to make it relevant for the audience in the 21st century. And all the things that I've just mentioned, I think are things that are relevant in our society. Now, not only, yes, it is a female empowerment story to on a certain level, it is also a love story. And the question of finding your way in your bubble is relevant to almost everybody, not even only to females. You have the same thing, you know, for young men. They need to find their way. And investing into a character that is so charming and is so courageous is something that I think is the right ingredient. And then from, you know, that is storytelling. That's the creative side. That's the stuff that that works for the audience. From a producer's point of view, I think the biggest thing is you have to find a brand, because people need to know. When you go into a meeting and say, we want to make this show, you need to sell them. What do you have? Nothing. You don't even have a script sometimes. You have a vision. And it is infinitely easier, not for me as a producer or for any other producer, to come up with a vision. I can pitch you 5 stories right now with a vision that'll blow you away. The point is you have to be on the other side, the people that are making the decisions, that are putting the money down and are taking the risk. Will they understand what that vision is? How much do they think, do I understand this guy right? And it becomes infinitely easier to connect it to something that they know, something that they know has performed well over 70 years, quite the track record, I would say. So that's one of the reasons why you want to try and sell a brand along with a vision. And finding, in our particular way, finding the right way between what we sold as a vision, which is, this will work on Christmas, this will be a female empowerment story, this is something you've trusted for 70 years, then you need to put the creative in there. And that is hard, because you have to tip your hat towards what has come before, and you have to create something completely new that will rise to the same level. And we were very lucky with the entire creative team to be able to create something that flies on the same altitude.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that you're going into season 4. So let's talk about the past 3 seasons. What were the biggest challenges story-wise or production-wise? Because obviously it's based on a historical figure. How much constraint do you and your co-writers feel in the writer's room in regards to historical facts? And are there any particular scenes that are harder to write than others in your experience?
I think the biggest challenge is, and I've learned this the hard way. We had a different writer's room before the one that we ran the last 3 seasons with. Okay. The writers of all 3 seasons are Elena Hell and Robert Krause. Wonderful colleagues, friends of mine, who have done the lion's share of the writing over those past 3 seasons. We had a different writer's room before. And that writer's room did exactly the opposite of what we're doing right now. We had long discussions of what was she really like? What did she really do? And we wrote this down, and we came to the conclusion that this woman doesn't deserve a television show. She was not the most intriguing, the most charming, the most lovable person. And we spent so much time trying to fit the historical, the accuracy with storytelling that the storytelling took damage and didn't work. I wrote 3 scripts and we tossed them and we hired new writers. And it was not because the writers were not good. They were some of the best writers that I've written wonderful shows since then. Great great, great folks. But we made the wrong decision at the beginning, trying to square it off with the historical research. And with Robert and Elena, we said, no, we're going to go and tell our own story. We're going to create our own characters because we're not doing a documentary. We're not doing docu-fiction. We are squarely using these historical figures as artificial characters that we infuse life into, because that was the biggest decision that we made. And that's why the show is so successful, because these characters have become unique, recognizable, understandable, and lovable. And that's the key element. In terms of what are the hardest scenes to write, I think every scene is difficult because every time with every word, you make a decision of where the show will go from here on out. And that makes, you know, every line of dialogue, every scene heading says something about where this will go. So I can't say that anything is harder than the other. Some of it is quickly recognizably on page. This is going to be great. But we've filmed for 3 years. I can tell you, the most magical thing is when the next step in the creative process, the director, and then ultimately the people in front of the camera bring their own talent to what we have dreamt up and make this sing in a way that we have never, ever experienced it or thought about it. And that's just magical. And luckily, that happened in probably like the fourth scene in the first season. And I remember we shot it on the last day of the entire shooting block for season one. And Yannick Schumann, who plays the Emperor, it's literally the first time he comes up and gives us a real piece of dialogue. He's moving some chess pieces around, fairly standard setup. And then suddenly he just starts to giggle and you think that guy is nuts. And he made our, dark prince, the nuts dark prince. And that gave it gave it so much more. And Yannick is to be thanked for that he gave him that extra whole facet of this character that we continue exploring into season four. So that's the most amazing thing. We never wrote it. He brought it.
Do you have a favorite scene?
And right now I do. I can't tell you because we haven't shot it yet, but I have a second favorite scene.
Okay.
It's already available across the globe. We have a wonderful scene where the Empress in season three gets confirmation in form of a letter that her son has been disappeared and has been kidnapped. And it is Andy Fetcher, who was our director on the third season, set up this super long shot between the two friends. It is the Empress and her handmaid, and the handmaid has the letter, and it is 40 meters, 30 yards between these two women, and it takes forever. The Empress knows, the audience knows, takes 20 seconds until she actually takes the piece of paper and gets confirmation, and it just rips your heart out before she even gets the letter. It's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Romy Schneider earlier and her embodiment of the Empress. Casting is very important. How long was the casting process? What were you looking for specifically for the roles of Sissi and Franz?
Specifically, we were looking for exactly what we got.
Wonderful.
An unknown quantity, beautiful, talented, charming, one that could carry these heavy costumes for over 70 days without complaining and nailing every scene. Now, that was the list that we had. This is what Dominique Davenport delivered. The process was fairly simple. For me, I got an e-casting first from her because Dominique was still a student at the Munich Acting School. Nobody had ever heard of her. I hadn't heard of her. Our casting director, Franziska Eigner, got us a casting reel. And I remember to this day, she slides in from the right into the frame and she giggles and she introduced herself. And I was done. I was like, that's it. I'm sold.
Mm-hmm.
There was weeks of conversations about this and the other and how about here. And she did it again in the physical casting and the constellation mm-hmm. casting with Yannick. She can turn this bubbly charm on and she commands a room when she's in that role. It's amazing. And so in that respect, for me and Franziska, we were like, that's it. We got her. We were so lucky.
Yeah.
And she delivered right in the beginning. I remember the first day of shooting when she was in the costume for the first time in the set. And the set designer, who is a very experienced set designer in the Baltics, he walks into his own set that he has built for 2 months. Mm-hmm. And he walks in and he sees the emperor stand there. And he instinctively took a bow.
It's a historical series, music, costumes. There's a certain atmosphere that needs to be created. I'm guessing the costume budget was a bit of a challenge, which was solved quite beautifully. Tell us a little bit about that.
We started this at the beginning of the pandemic.
Jesus, yeah.
So traveling, you know, we already knew that we were not going to find these costumes and rent them. We rented second and third background. There's rental stuff in there, but not
the main costume. Yeah.
The main costumes, we routinely make between 60 and 80 dresses for the Empress alone. And then there are the rest of the cast. So when we designed those costumes, you know, it's a budget. It's every budget is not enough money.
Mm-hmm.
Not just spoken as a producer who always whines about not having enough money.
Yeah.
It is true. It's never enough, because with the budget and with your aspirations and the demands of the clients, demands of the world distributor, with the budget rises the mm-hmm. expectations, and you need to deliver. And we knew it's never enough. And we did, you know, I remember we went through line items at the beginning and we cut things down to get it into budget. The one that we didn't ever discuss was the costume budget. That was just, we said, that's it. I'd rather have one less carriage, but two more dresses. And that was the right decision. And we continue to do that, because this is also where the show, this is where the tone is set in a material way, because the warm, luscious, historically, maybe not entirely accurate, but they look damn good. And I have so many friends, I mean, literally, who come and want to just be an extra in one of those costumes. Then, you know, sometimes one or two get them and they're like, oh my God, that's really hard work. I was like, yeah, it's really hard work just for one day in those costumes.
Yeah, it's heavy. And then, you know, sometimes you have obviously hair pieces and stuff.
Yeah.
It's like a whole different beast.
Just imagine going to the bathroom in a hoop dress.
Yeah.
Is a challenge.
Yeah, I remember, I don't even know, I think it was Carey Mulligan at some point. She mentioned, because she had just done a historical film, that she always stood or she leaned against a pillar because, you know, you're so constrained in the corsets and everything. There's really no way for you to move in any way.
Yeah.
Just briefly about the music. Was there anything specifically you wanted or something that you wanted to avoid music-wise for the series?
Yes. So our composer is Jessica DeRoy. Mm-hmm. She's amazing. She's done all three series. Our first director, Sven Boza, recommended her. And in that discussion between Sven and Jessica, it became very clear that we wanted to avoid one of those big pitfalls. The show it's a period show. But it is a period show that actually has real relevant and young themes that we're discussing, that we're experiencing there. We wanted to clearly signal that this is a modern show.
Mm-hmm.
And for us to make a decision that we were not going to go the classical route, the very on-note score, that we wanted to avoid that. So what Jessica tried to do was try to find a way to get modern sounds into it without avoiding the other pitfall of putting an electric guitar riff in there. We had one in there, which we discussed a long time, whether that's... But, you know, she found ways and created sounds that previously didn't exist that make it sound very unique and very modern.
Nice. Yeah, because sometimes, I don't know if you remember from the first Bridgerton series where they used sort of like modern songs played by a string quartet. That did sort of work, but sometimes I felt it was a little bit too much.
Bridgerton was a big deal for us too, because they came out at the same time. We had a chance to look at it, learn a little bit of what worked at Bridgerton. That it becomes a little exhaustive if the audience starts playing that game while you want them to watch your show. So it creates a little bit of a distance because you feel the artificiality of it. Granted, Bridgerton does want you to look at an artificial world. That's the promise and that they deliver on very well. We didn't make that decision. We wanted to continue to create a world that people can enter and stay in and never be asked to leave. And we wanted to make sure that these would be a young audience that would be entering. So the story, the themes, and the music needed to be attractive, especially for a young audience.
Yeah. Now, let's pivot a little bit towards Heimatfilm, talking about the Sissi films earlier. Do you have a personal or emotional connection to the genre at all?
Not in the sense that I watched it more than anything else. I'm very cognizant of it.
Yeah.
In Europe, those movies, everybody who grew up in the last century knows about them.
We didn't really have a choice. With the three channels.
Yes. But, you know, the fact that those filmmakers back in the 50s were also doing what we're doing today. They are offering engagement through emotion. And that's what we do. And, you know, I keep thinking about what the audience will take away from our show. Mm-hmm. I am sure that Marishka and the entire team that made those three movies were thinking about their audience as well. And when they created a world where everything was bright, everything was great, you have to understand that these movies came out 10 years after the biggest catastrophe in Europe, which left no country and no family untouched. And the fact that these people, now we're looking at it and we're sort of like joking about, but we didn't experience what the audience back then experienced. We don't have that feeling that we want to be safe. We want to know that the world will be good again.
Yeah.
These people, I mean, there were people 10 years later. I just read a book about the 10 years after World War II. There were people still, you know, forced laborers from Eastern Europe and even from France that did not leave camps in Germany until the 1960s. The last camp was dissolved in 1963. This audience needed that. Our audience has a different, they have no memory of this, which is ghastly when you think of it, how short human memory really is.
Yeah.
And our world has different issues. Our world has questions of how to deal with authority, finding your own way, finding out who you are key issues that we seem to be dealing with right now, because we don't have these exterior pressures in the sense that we have a war that we've just gotten. I mean, it's not like the world is great right now, but it is outside of inflation and paying for your food and gas and all of these things. We're still a fairly safe place. So we have different issues. This can change on a dime. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it doesn't. But I think you have to be cognizant of what your audience needs. And then the other thing is, as every good storyteller, you want to go back to what works. A love story will work if told right. And so mixing those things together, I don't know if our show qualifies as a Heimat film these days.
Well, your show itself not. It sort of grew out of
it's, Yeah, it's a natural continuation of that genre. And that's a wonderful thing that these things have relevancy over that limited genre.
Yeah. And as you said, you know, the 1950s films, that was sort of like a prettified version of reality. But what I find very interesting also, you know, that they held a certain promise of reinvention and of a better future in a way. And I still think that does happen today as well in many films and many shows. Given that, you know, obviously Heimatfilm is a very tricky genre, Do you think it still has a place in today's German film industry or the film industry in general?
Totally. Yes. But if you take this as a very, very broad, you know, I mean, why not? Now that you mention it, why not? Nobody has done a good old mountain climbing film that works. Maybe one should try their hand at it. But if you look at the rest of the world, isn't there this genre that we have a word for? The Americans have a word for it. It's called Western.
Yes.
If you look at the most successful television shows in America right now, I think without doubt, Yellowstone is probably the yes. most successful. 5 seasons, 2 prequels. You know, that's a Heimat film.
Let's not forget about Justified.
Yes.
One of the best shows ever.
I agree. But Justified is set there. Yellowstone is the title and the land is the subject.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I think if you qualify it as, if you say, you know, if the landscape, your home landscape becomes a character, well, we always look for that because that usually makes filmmaking easier if you have another character that as a producer, you don't have to pay. You don't have to worry about whether the mountain's going to be there. It's going to show up every time and nobody has to drive it to the set. That's right.
True. Yeah, I mean, Hans Steinbechler found his sort of his own way of working in that genre, and obviously Edgar Reitz.
Of course. Absolutely. I think those shows that you just mentioned, they become part of the national character of people that live in that region because there's a touchstone of a common history that is signified by the place. So yeah, I think there will always be that thing that can only be done in this environment. It will have its relevance.
Yeah. I mean, for me, in a way, for Sissy, it's obviously not a place. It's the person who personifies, you know, a certain feeling of belonging or maybe not belonging because she tried to find her place in that new environment and her freedom. And I think that, as you mentioned earlier, that's something that people still identify and still deal with today. Now, a couple of questions about you and your work.
Okay. Oh, my.
You've been working as a producer and writer for a while, and you've co-founded your own production company, Storyhouse Productions. I know this is a bit of a loaded question, so feel free to answer as shortly as you want. How do you look towards the changes that are currently rocking the film and TV industry? Because it's not an easy time.
It's not an easy time, but I am an eternal optimist. Otherwise, I think I wouldn't want to be in this business.
Mm-hmm.
I've been through downturns before. In 2008, I was working in the United States where our clients called us and said, don't call us in the next 8 months.
Jeez.
We're not going to order anything. And we devised strategies around that and stayed alive. Mm-hmm. I think you always have to be nimble. You always have to understand where the opportunities in terms of running a production company and producing are coming from. Our strategy is fairly simple. We want to make sure that if things are getting hard in individual markets, the obvious place is to combine markets. And so international co-productions are certainly something that we like it. We love it. We've never failed.
Yeah.
Knock on wood. So that is certainly something that we want to pursue. And, you know, it's more complicated than just getting one phone call and getting the budget and just doing the show.
Yeah.
It is because you have one thing at the table and you pull on the little tablecloth that's always too short. You pull it towards one and the one thing, you know, and the other, then the sugar falls down and it's just, it's
a lot of moving pieces. Yeah,
exactly. But that's one way to look at it. And I do believe that, the quality of the storytelling, people will always need that. How much are they going to be able to afford to pay for it is the question. And if you're looking at the consolidation that's going on with American streamers pulling out of Europe, it's terrible. But let's think about it. 4 years ago, they weren't here.
True.
So that's just the way life is. There's always going to be change. You got to be quick on your feet, you know. Fly like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
Very true. I have 3 pictures of Muhammad Ali.
There we go.
Plus, a good story will always be a good story. I believe that. And I think it will always find a home. Talking about stories, is there a particular story that you would like to tackle that you haven't had the chance to yet?
Well, yes, of course there is. How much money do you have?
Oh, God. Never enough.
Never enough. Thank you. You listen well. You know, the show that we did for CC was Dignity for Join and HBO and Amazon, international co-production with Chile. This was done in Latin America. You can imagine the budget is miles from what we are working with at CC. So I think that money does not guarantee a good show. We were nominated for the Grimme Prize for Dignity for, you know, peanuts compared to what we're working with at CC. It's not really a question of money. But then at a certain level, it becomes a question of money, because when you're looking at international co-productions, people get weary of projects that are too cheap because they think that it'll be a cheap looking show and a show where the creatives will take shortcuts to make it work. Granted, yes, that is a real danger, and therefore you need to have a certain amount. The project that we're working on right now that our heart is set on is an international co-production. Mm-hmm. It's an English language show that is made for the global market. We bought the rights to Sue Monk Kidd's book, The Book of Longing. She wrote The Secret Life of Bees. She also wrote The Book of Longings. And it's the easiest show to pitch because I didn't have to write anything because Sue already wrote the first sentence of the book. And the first sentence of the book is, "My name is Anna. I was the wife of Jesus of Nazareth." Enough said.
Very true.
This is a show about a Jewish princess that has it all and then loses everything and finds true love and true meaning. And that's powerful. It's relevant. The only drawback is it's period. And people instinctively say, we don't want to do period. And then I'm like, yeah, but the stuff works. So think again.
Fingers crossed. And that was it. Thank you so much for sitting down with us today. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.